It is April the 26th, 2019, and this is episode 9 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Coming up on this episode, we discuss the urgent bites on Segond fractures, the Simmons-Thompson test, and antibiotics for UTI in the elderly. We look at another interesting case of objects under the eyelids. We look again at why kids swallow foreign bodies. And we look forward to the upcoming urgent care boot camp and discuss other college news. So welcome to episode 9 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose and I'm your host, and I'm joined as ever by the co-host Dave Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training. Hello, Dave.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Now, in a little bit we'll also be joined by Afraz Adam, our Director of Professional Development, but we'll start, Dave, with a little look at the bites from the last month, and we'll include one bite from the previous month, because we didn't really have a proper episode last time. It was the one that we recorded in the Goodfellow Symposium. But the most recent bite was about Segond fractures, which is the lateral tibial avulsion fracture seen on the AP views of knee x-rays, and has a high incidence of associated ACL rupture, between 75% and 100% in some studies. So what's your feeling and experience on Segond fractures?
So obviously with Segond fractures, you pick up that the tenderness is laterally, and so you are wondering about a lateral fibular head fracture or a lateral tibial fracture. And so it's an index of suspicion thing. You're thinking this is lateral, so either there's going to be an LCL tear, which is not too much of a drama, but the Segond fracture is more dramatic and will need better investigation and obviously an MRI. And where you work will determine how you manage that. Is that something you refer acutely, or do you have rapid access to an orthopedic surgeon? In our case, we can do either, that we have usually a once a week knee clinic that the orthopedic surgeon can order an MRI. So we're reasonably comfortable, if we know they can be seen within 7 days, of putting them in a Zimmer splint and getting the orthopod to review with the MRI. But if you can't do that, obviously you need to talk to the acute service and make sure that they're managed in a timely fashion. And I can't say I've actually heard of the reverse Segond phenomenon, so it's something I've learned.
Yeah, it was mentioned alongside the article that I posted underneath the podcast, but they look quite innocuous on the x-ray, just a little slither. That you know, so many other avulsion injuries that we see don't require anything too significant, but this is actually associated with reasonably significant injuries of the knee. So my first occurrence of finding it was actually in the x-ray reports. The radiology report said there is a Segond fracture, and then you look up a Segond fracture and you go, oh goodness, that's, because it's, if you haven't seen one before, your first impression might be it does look like a relatively slight injury. My question to you would be the Ottawa knee rules, though, to determine whether somebody needs an x-ray beforehand. If somebody has ruptured their ACL, do you feel that they would meet the criteria for an x-ray, as in would they be weight-bearing 3 steps?
Well,
if they're under 55?
I think they'll probably have a hemarthrosis, and so that would sidestep the Ottawa to say anyone with a hemarthrosis must have some type of significant injury and so therefore should have a knee x-ray. So every rule has its diversion policy, and my diversion policy for a knee is, did it swell up straight away? Answer yes, right, it's a hemarthrosis equals x-ray. So it's kind of, will any hemarthrosis should have an x-ray. Will it possibly fail the Ottawa knee rule? Yes, I think sometimes it might. However, I think that we have a much lower policy of x-raying knees in a similar fashion to shoulders. So Craig Ball's talk on shoulders at the Goodfellow Unit reinforced to me that there's a very low threshold for x-ray for the shoulder, and I think there's a very low threshold for x-ray of the knee. And so I think that you should probably be able to determine using that rule or clinical judgment that an x-ray is indicated.
Certainly when you refer people with knee injuries, maybe suspected meniscal injuries or ACL injuries to an orthopaedic surgeon, they expect an x-ray, even if they haven't technically met the criteria for Ottawa. So you've got to apply a little bit of flexibility to the rule. But yeah, certainly it's worth being aware, particularly if you're a trainee, if you're relatively new to urgent care and you look at an x-ray and see a little slither off the lateral tibia before you get the x-ray report, just bear in mind that a second should have an orthopaedic review for MRI, unless someday arrives where we're able to do MRIs in urgent care, but that's another topic. And yeah, the reverse second was mentioned, which is seemed to be from the posterior collateral ligament, although nowhere that I could find agreed what actually causes this avulsion, which structure. It's just when you see it, the ACL is likely to have gone. So it's that there is many different structures that could have pulled that most people seem to think it's the lateral capsular ligament that's pulled it off when the ACL is injured. But it's
important to remember that you're not seeing the ACL. The second fracture is not the ACL. Mm. You can't see the ACL, except for the rare sort of teenage fracture where they actually pull a big slither of bone with it. So it's a sign to point to something else.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way that often a Liz Frank, you're not actually seeing the dislocation directly.
And you're seeing that little slither and you're thinking, how can that be, how can that be related to the ACL? It's like you say, it's the association. It isn't a direct consequence. So it's worth knowing about, and so we did that. And also I thought it was interesting that it was a French surgeon who pioneered vaginal hysterectomies who put his name to that fracture. You've mentioned Liz Frank. He was did a lot of gynecological surgery as well before naming a foot fracture. So it seems that these French surgeons
have a foot in every field.
Very much so. The bite before that was another orthopaedic one, and this was inspired by the talk we went to at the Goodfellow on Achilles ruptures, and that was the Simmons-Thompson test for determining if somebody has an Achilles rupture. And whether it's just my brain, I feel I get confused about whether or not the test is positive, because you call it positive when you squeeze the calf and nothing happens. And most other tests I can think of has always been you have a pain there when you do it and you call it positive. So I get confused about it. So I quite like the Life in the Fast Lane article, because it ended at the end saying a good way to document it is there was plantar flexion with Simmons-Thompson test, or there was absent plantar flexion. And by wording it like that, there's no confusion with anyone reading your notes.
And I think that's a very important point in general for all documentation, that when we use an eponym or someone's name, it's important that everyone understands what we're talking about, because not everyone is, is it a bird, is it a plane? No, it's Superman. And so Simmons-Thompson's calf squeeze, plantar flexion absence, I think that's probably the best way of documenting, especially when you're considering that it's not something, and that's when you're excluding something, that's important. But also, when you put someone to a cast, they can't do that test until they take that cast off. So if you're saying there's no plantar flexion, then you're saying clinically, I think this is an Achilles rupture, and so clinically they're in a cast. But if you didn't document it correctly, you didn't do it. So
yeah,
it's another point.
if you refer to an orthopaedic surgeon with a patient in the cast and you've written Simmons-Thompson negative, because you make the mistake I do, which is nothing happened, so it's negative, then that can lead to maybe the surgeon saying, well, if it's negative, why they put them in the cast? And
then they take the cast off.
They take the cast off. So it's so documentation is obviously important. But I was interested, I asked in the Bite, and I've not had any correspondence. I was asking for any other test that's negative with a, that's positive with a, with when nothing happens, when there's an absence of something. Because when we were talking before, we mentioned Finkelstein's, we mentioned Rovsing's, we've mentioned the Mulder's sign. I think Murphy's sign is positive when there's pain. So many of these signs seem to be positive when there is presence of something like pain. And I was just interested if anybody did know of any other negative ones that, that you get confused around. But the Simmons-Thompson was the only one I could think of.
So you got negative replies.
Negative replies, absolutely. And then we had the Goodfellow, which I hope everyone's listened to, with the discussion with John Bonning about various decision tools around pulmonary embolism. And because of that, the length of that podcast and timings, we didn't have our usual discussion around the Bite. So the prior to that, we had the study from the BMJ that looked at antibiotics for UTI in the elderly, that found that if you delayed antibiotics or gave no antibiotics for elderly people with UTI, it had a 7- and 8-fold increase in mortality or significant bloodstream infections. When we were talking about this earlier, when we look at it, we didn't think that it actually changed the way that you would manage an elderly person with a UTI, and we got to talking about children and elderly are managed fairly similar in this regard, and then there's the cohort in the middle. So how do you manage elderly UTIs in elderly?
It is interesting because there is some documentation that's come up in Auckland from lab tests talking about not treating UTIs and delayed management. But I think you've got the extremes of age, which are different. So young children with UTIs. Now, bearing in mind that you have to have a good enough test to prove that you're treating a UTI. So in children and in the elderly, you do need a clean catch urine suggesting that it's a UTI before you start antibiotics, ideally. You can't, it's difficult when you can't confirm in any objective test, and I would include a dipstick urine to suggest that there is signs of a UTI. And I guess the big debate is when you don't have a urine and is it undifferentiated unwellness? And I have a concern about treating undifferentiated unwellness with antibiotics and presuming it's a UTI. But if in any situation where you have an unwell person and you have a dipstick urine suggesting a UTI, I would be pretty much always starting antibiotics. Sometimes it's challenging to choose the right antibiotics in some patients, especially if they've had a history of, you know, resistant urine infection. So whenever I have the opportunity, I go through test safe for previous urine tests to see what's, and sometimes you get some big surprises about what your options are. But I think it is a good medicine to treat early a UTI. But I have concern about when it's not necessarily a UTI.
Yeah, there's often elderly people diagnosed with a UTI on a, similar to a kid, a non-clean catch kind of specimen. There's a lot of contaminant, particularly in kind of bedridden elderly people in nursing homes. And so the report will often say, you know, suspect contamination, or this might be a sample of contamination. But you do a urine as part of a off-leg screen, I guess, and that's what general medicine inpatients often get, don't they? Whereas, I guess, in the community, if you're worried about an elderly patient with an you're unclear as the diagnosis, and maybe they're drowsy, they're a bit off, you're probably referring them as off legs to the medical reg for that full workup. But if somebody comes in with very clear symptoms of UTI and dipstick positive, then you're going to treat them. So I don't think that study would have changed the way that we manage those. But it's interesting to know that if you don't treat them, then they do have a significant negative outcome. that was the bites covered. If we move to some news items now. There's one article that was in the BBC, but I've seen it in a lot of other publications, which I thought was interesting, and it relates back to the very first episode of this podcast when we discussed a lady who had a long-lost contact lens under the eyelid. And this was a lady in, I think it was Taiwan, who went to the doctor with a swollen upper eyelid, and they removed 4 bees from under her eyelid. So it's another lesson in checking underneath the tarsal plate to complete your eye exam.
It's amazing what people can hide under there, and it's always an interesting thing to do, and I've certainly learnt more recently from Prof. Gray to put the fluorescein in before I avert the eyelid, because often foreign objects can be invisible until fluorescein's there. And I certainly did show one of the nurses the other day that very example of once I put the fluorescein in, the foreign object that was slightly lucent, and a really good example of that is contact lenses. It was clearly visible once we'd put the fluorescein on, and I could easily remove it with a cotton bud, and there it was. I wouldn't expect to be removing live bees. That's not the usual thing that I've seen, but I've seen lots of other items hidden under the lens, including contact lenses.
And it used to be the really expensive old contact lenses, that the permanent ones that you would stain permanently if you put fluorescein in. So there was this kind of fear, but I don't think many people have those nowadays. They're mainly disposable, so you don't really have that fear of causing any harm by putting the fluorescein in.
And if it's already in the wrong place and you need to remove it, and it's probably broken, you need to find it.
So there's no other reason not to put fluorescein in early, as though it doesn't mask any other things.
Not that I'm aware of, unless they actually have a deeply penetrating wound, but then routinely you look for Sydell's sign using the fluorescein as well.
So it's a good thing to put fluorescein in. The story here was a 28-year-old woman who, Taiwan it was, who was pulling out weeds, and a load of insects flew into her face, and she then went on to develop swelling around her eyelid, went to the doctor, and they pulled these bees out. Apparently they're sweat bees, which are attracted to sweat, and they've been known to drink tears for the high protein content, it says. But there's a few pictures and videos of these little things coming out from under the eyelid. So it is important. I don't think I've ever seen anything that big, but the patients are usually able to locate something under the eyelid. They kind of know there's something under there quite often. They're quite specific, I find, that something's there. Do you find that?
The closest I've seen to that is a person who had a bee stinger stuck through the anterior cornea and into the anterior chamber, with the venom pulsating into the anterior chamber. I've never actually seen a completely live bee anywhere near the eye. But they do localize, and they usually say, yes, I'm certain there's something there. And it pays to be able to completely avert the lid and have a really good look around. That picture looks like it would be very challenging to avert that lid.
Yes, yeah. She's got a very red, swollen eyelid. So I think if that had come into our clinic, and I think you'd be said the same, I would be referring that to the ophthalmologist for intravenous antibiotics and further workup, because the lid was very red and swollen and cellulitic looking. The other thing I find with subtarsal foreign bodies is with the fluorescein in, you often see on the cornea nice little up and down scrapes, which often gives the game away if you haven't found it. The other article that was interesting, because it relates back to when we did our 12 Bites of Christmas with kids swallowing things, was a report in CNN that researchers in the US have published in the journal Pediatrics. There has been a doubling of emergency room visits in the US in the last 20 years with kids swallowing things. ingesting foreign objects, coins, toys, jewelry, button batteries, screws, and the like. And I was interested by this partly because we discussed it and went through the various different things to be aware of, the button batteries and the magnets and the like. But a doubling in 20 years, what would cause that? I mean, kids have always presumably put things in their mouth, is it?
It's an interesting concept. And of course, a corollary to that is the YouTube phenomenon of things like the dishwashing powder swallowing, causing obviously these catastrophic esophageal injuries. And that's certainly something that has happened, and that they'll have this challenge of swallowing. And so it's, I wonder if it's a similar thing, that kids find the challenge to swallow this, that and the other. And of course there's the child in Australia who swallowed a slug and ended up with a very nasty parasitic infection leading to catastrophic brain injury. And so whether it's a challenge thing, that it's a challenge to swallow this, but I think that's probably in an older age group. The younger age group, I'm not quite sure why they decide to swallow more things.
The other interesting thing about the article was it did say that they feel it might be an underestimate because they only looked at emergency rooms, and they specifically say this line: they may also have seen their primary care doctors or urgent care centres. So it's nice to see the word urgent care centre in a news article there. But it's worth reiterating, I guess, that the button battery is obviously a worry, and magnets, particularly more than one, that
and corrosive agents.
And anything corrosive, like you say, those dishwasher tabs and
very colourful,
and other things are not good to eat. That was about it. All I could find in the world news that was relevant to what we do. But in New Zealand news, what's relevant to urgent care is the doctors' strikes, the junior doctors' strikes that have been ongoing. Now, these don't involve any urgent care clinic because these are hospital doctors, junior doctors, but these strikes seem to be getting longer. I mean, this latest one was five days, I think, the one that's currently ongoing. Have you noticed any effect on urgent care clinics in your experience because of the strike? Or?
Well, the only effect that we tend to have is that we end up talking to someone a little bit more senior in the food chain when we ring up, that we're often talking to a consultant in their field rather than the registrar, which I don't think is a negative effect whatsoever, and you certainly have more interesting conversations sometimes. Mm. I guess we better not get into the political nature, but but it is important that junior doctors are supported for their terms and conditions, and there's lots of interest in this worldwide when it comes to the phenomenon of burnout and the effect of working conditions on junior doctors, and lots of books talk about this, like Also Human, which reflects on what it's like being a junior doctor and a doctor throughout the world, and also This Is Gonna Hurt, with Adam Kay's experience as a junior doctor in the UK. And so we need to remember that doctors are human and they need to have decent conditions.
Yeah, I've always thought it's worth thinking, if your loved one had to go into hospital, who would you want them to be seeing when they were there? Would you want them to have a doctor who's not rushed off their feet because of... we can all have busy shifts due to an unusual seasonal demand or something on one particular day. But if it's an ongoing chronic thing that you're overworked, then mistakes can get made. And I guess you want your, as you say, doctors are human, and getting a medical degree doesn't infer some kind of superhuman quality on you. But from an urgent care perspective, I've not noticed any difference in terms of throughput through the clinics. But like you say, the phone calls to the hospital, you're generally getting a senior doctor, and that is interesting because you've got to, it's part of the training is for junior doctors to take calls, but when you speak to a consultant who gives you the option of seeing the patient in their clinic the next day, or they seem to be more comfortable in managing things outside of the hospital, it is a different dynamic speaking to a consultant versus a junior doctor when you're referring somebody.
I think that, you know, they don't have to talk to their senior, and they can make a decision, and they have the power to suggest different clinics acutely, and even coming in directly for an operation the next day. So it is different, but obviously you've still got to sometimes remind them of what usually happens with certain conditions. There are a lot of, you know, they've had all those years of experience, and they can give you a lot of answers that you may not necessarily get from the junior doctor, and not to belittle the junior doctors at all. I think that they will do a wonderful job. And I think it's good, because I think that the consultants are not letting the standard of care lapse, that they're trying to do the same job under, you know, difficult circumstances, and so that's good, because we've always got to be our patient's advocate as well, and we're not trying to manage unsafely in the community. They're still taking the patients, they're just having to do it a different way.
Right, so let's move on to some college stuff and some CME stuff. And as if by magic, we're joined by Dr. Afraz Adam, our Director of Professional Development. Hello, Afraz.
Hello, Guy.
Right, and Dave is still with us. So on our website, there is a link to a conference that's happening in Las Vegas, and I believe there's a discount for our college members. So, and one of us in this room might be attending, I believe. And Dave, I'm not sure what your travel plans are, but I'm not going to Vegas anytime soon. So, Afraz.
Yes, I believe Dave, I beat you to this one. I'm going to Vegas. Yes, guys, we have the Essentials of Emergency Medicine conference coming up. Now, this is a very popular, worldwide popular emergency medicine conference that happens every year. And usually it happens in Vegas. I haven't ever heard of this being hosted anywhere else in the world. It is a very fast-paced conference. It is very intense, very similar to our upcoming boot camp in September, and it encompasses all facets of emergency medicine and acute care medicine, and extends all the way to family and urgent care medicine as well. It's coming up on May the 13th and goes on for 4 days up till May 16th, and it's been held at the Cosmopolitan Hotel in Las Vegas this year.
And what is the deal in terms of registering for college members?
Yes, the college has secured a deal with Hippo Medicine, who have agreed to give every registrar and fellow registering for the conference $100 off its registration fee. Now, just to remember, if you are a registrar registering for the conference, you can register not as a fellow but as a resident, and you get a much, much sweeter deal than a fellow would. So, the registrar wins double fold,
$100 and a cheaper fee,
okay. Yeah, as it is for medical students as well.
And this is presumably CME claimable. It's been approved for CME.
Definitely, you can claim up to a maximum of 6 points per day. If you attend the pre-workshop that precedes a conference, it makes it 4 days, so you can claim up to 24 points for the whole conference.
And presumably you'll be too busy going to the conference to experience any of the Las Vegas.
I'm not going there for anything else. No. I'm just going there purely for urgent care education. I'll come back and report further on that.
And you mentioned the boot camp. Might be a good time to roll into that. What can you tell us about the boot camp? You raised this earlier in the year in the DPD update. Is there anything?
Yes, that's correct, Guy. We are rolling on with the bootcamp. In fact, we as an office had a meeting now that Goodfellow Symposium's over. We had a meeting early morning today, and as you can see in the board up there, it is just full on. We've got ideas rolling. It is going to be intense. It is going to be fast paced. It's going to be fun. It's going to be educational. It's going to be like nothing this college has ever had before. It's going to be absolutely amazing. Way better than the conference I'm attending in Vegas. And of course, Auckland's way better than Vegas. So we're hosting it in Auckland this year.
Sky City.
Yes, of course.
So it's one day.
That's correct.
And it's what are the lengths, anticipated lengths of talk? Is it when you
the,
say fast-paced?
The talks are going to be fast-paced, and the shortest talk will be 5 minutes long, and the longest talk will be 15 minutes long. We are not going to have any conversation more than 15 minutes. It's going to be very, very intense with no breaks in between. You'll be lucky if you get a lunch break squeezed in there, but it'll be 8 hours of pure medical education, pure urgent care talk.
Great. So to watch this space in terms of speakers and...
By the end of this week, Everyone should receive in their inboxes an expression of interest invite, whereby I would be asking anyone who's interested in speaking at the event to submit an expression of interest. This does not necessarily mean that you will be presenting at the event, but I would like to see what ideas our fellows and registrars have, which they want to bring forth to the event. We'll have about 20 to 25 presenters at this event. No one will be speaking more than once, just to allow everyone a fair opportunity. And it will be heavily incentivized as well. All speakers, in addition to their daily 6 points allowance for attending the boot camp, will get further CME points for their preparation and for the presentation. They will also get a free entry, of course, free registration for the boot camp, and they will get a special invite to attend the fellowship dinner ceremony at the Cordis Hotel on the night.
Wonderful. So that sounds like things are moving forward apace. And if you're listening to this, watch your inbox. The other thing, Dave, that was on the website, and I think there was an email out, was the research paper has had a change in name, at least. Is there anything else to say on that?
So there has been a slight review of the research project, and the instructions have been made more specific. So it hasn't actually changed, but we're trying to make it a lot more clear. And the decision was made that it's probably better be called the Medical Literature Project rather than the Research Project. And one of the reasons for that is it's not necessarily going to be just research. So for all those registrars who are having to do it, it's either a case study, a research project, or a guideline. And so this has made it a lot more clear as to what the expectations are, and to try to make it easier to understand what we ask, so that you don't have to ask as many questions, although we're more than welcome to ask us what you need to know.
Excellent. So you guys got anything else to add from a college perspective, either for registrars or fellows?
Do you, Dave?
No, I think that's everything. The only thing I would say, we obviously have a different perspective of what an early morning meeting is.
Yes, early morning for me is 11 o'clock, Dave. Thank you very much.
Email in your suggestions. What do you consider an early morning? Let's take a poll of the listeners. Early morning meeting.
Early morning
times?
For Dave is to be here at the office at 5:30 in the morning. That's not my idea for an early morning, guys.
So, Afraz, you missed the Goodfellow Symposium. The place was quieter because you were not there.
Thanks, Guy.
There was much less action, but you weren't there for a good reason. And what were you doing instead of going to the Goodfellow?
That's correct, Guy. I was absolutely gutted to have missed the Goodfellow Symposium, but I was trying to be in touch with one of our college principals, one of our college strategies, and that is giving back to the community. I signed up, I believe I've spoken to you about this before, I signed up to the Oxfam Trail Walk, which was a 100K walk in Whakatane, and it coincided with the same weekend with the Goodfellow Symposium. My team and I, a team of three personal trainers and myself, we managed to complete the 100K walk in 29 hours and 45 minutes. We took minimal breaks. We also managed
to sleep.
No, we did not sleep at all. We had lots of muesli bars along the way, and we became quite delirious by the end of it.
Did you have some IV fluid?
And I've ended up with a very bad peroneal tendon injury as well from it, from just simple overuse. But we managed to raise $4,500. Towards Oxfam, and this has gone to a lot of poor, needy children who need access to vaccination in Vanuatu and other South Pacific countries as well. So it is all for a good cause, and I believe my only message to everyone is there's something innately satisfying about getting involved in projects like this. And as a college, we want to support any of our members, fellows and registrars out there who would want to get involved in a project that involves giving back in some way or the other. If you need help in spreading the message, if you need our help in any way possible, where we can promote you on our website, we can promote with through our newsletters, please do get in touch with us. If you need support, if you need me to come along with you in one of your projects, I'll be more than happy to help if I'm available. So just contact us if you have any ideas for a charity event that you want to run on behalf of the college.
Fantastic. So that's a decent amount of money for an injury that you've now been... You've it's had some CME in that as well, because you've learned about... You've experienced an injury as well. So, yeah, well done. Hats off for achieving that. And Dave, thank you for, as always, being the co-host. And Afraz, first time since episode one, appearing on the main podcast.
Right.
So good
thank
to have you.
You
back. And again, I extend a message to everybody out there listening. If you'd like to be involved and talk on the podcast for any reason, please email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. The more the merrier in terms of contributors and voices and opinions and ideas. We've got a lot of things lined up for the coming months, so hopefully everybody enjoys those, but open to lots of suggestions. So please email and yeah, thanks, guys, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you very much, Guy.
Thanks for listening.
And depending on when you're listening from, it's good night from me or good morning.
And it's good night from him. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.